that building full of fright. I dreamt that I was with the devil below, in his great big fiery hall, where the devil was giving a ball. I checked my coat and hat and started gazing at the merry crowd who came to witness the show. And I must confess to you, there were many there I knew.
Hello.
Hi.
At the devil's ball.
Welcome to The Dispatchist, a friendly conversation about hell and some other stuff. I'm Jacob, and with me this week is nobody in particular. The hosts are taking a little vacation for life and spring and such. So in the place of our usual banter, if you would care to enjoy a presentation I recently made at Texas Furry Fiesta, this week's topic is Howling with the Goetia.
Hi, everybody. Do I sound fairly clear and comprehensible?
Yeah!
I'm going to fix that pretty soon, actually. So, hi, my name is Corbeau. Sometimes I'm Caracal, sometimes I'm Jacob Williamson. I'm the creator and co-host of The Dispatchist, a friendly conversation about hell and some other stuff. We've been covering hell as a podcast for 3 years. In 2020, it was a really good idea. Good year for hell. And last year, I did a presentation on the history of demonology. And I've actually done that presentation like 3 times now, I think, in different forms. So this is all new material. I want to try something new and different. If you'd like to catch that 1.5 hour presentation, go to the app and look for this event here, and it's in the discussion notes. If you have any questions you want to ask later on or want to leave a 5-star review, and certainly you can go there as well. The app is a really great resource. So, okay, so let's go on to the next. Dispatch.ist. I've also got cards up here, as well as a few grimoires you can flip through. Some of them are really cute. Okay. So, tonight we'll be talking about the Goetia. I will never say that name correctly again after that. They are simultaneously one of the oldest formal occult traditions on the planet and one of the least respected. And I think that's really interesting. The name means a variety of things, but it begins with the word howling or moaning. Not like wolves so much, but like a kind of doleful chants at a funeral. It's kind of, the origins of this tradition go back to like Greek funerary practices in like 500 BC or so. Thank you, love. That's my husband. He's very patient. Other synonyms for Goetia: sorcery, low magic, witchcraft, but not like fun witchcraft like Sabrina, but like really, like let's kiss a goat in the middle of a black woods and sacrifice babies and bring them sort of thing. Necromancy, demonolatry, these are all synonyms for Goetia, and that's kind of in keeping with the fact that this path has a very unsavory connection. I think it's really neat though. But from as far back as like 200 BC or so, it's been associated with magic that was fraudulent, magic with evil intent, or just kind of materialistic trash, really. The word Goetia comes from the word goens or goen, which is a sort of magician found in ancient Rome and late Greece, usually kind of a fraudsterish sort of tradition. They're also called wonder workers, but I think you kind of get the idea of like maybe a stagecraft magician as well as a seer. So they not very savory again. Reading from Aleister Crowley's Goetia, again, that's Aleister Crowley. It is no secret that to many modern students of esoterica, Goetia has a decidedly shady reputation. On a scale of spiritual practices, one might find Goetia sandwiched somewhere between pacts with the devil and addicted to a Ouija board. This attitude is understandable. After all, Goetia is the intentional conjuration of spirit beings who are by definition fallen angels, evil spirits, and demons. I've come to think of this tradition as kind of the BDSM of the occult world. So open question. Why is it worth talking about? And specifically, why is it worth talking about at Furry Fiesta, besides the fact that I do this every year? Well, it... So again, from a magical occult perspective, it is the oldest continually, possibly the oldest continually practiced occult tradition on Earth. Going back to 500 BC, it's a magical system with European roots, which means that for someone like me, who is pasty French-German, this is a tradition that I can claim as an ancestral path, and that's kind of rare with these ancient traditions. Cultural appropriation is very challenging in the magical community. But also a hell of a boss. The Goetia figure very heavily into the hell of a boss plot, which is neat, although Vivzi Pop's interpretations of them are kind of, they deviate from what I would call demon canon. That's okay. And they have a fairly high furry content. This is Marchiosis. She is usually in the shape of a crudeless she-wolf with a griffin's wings and a serpent's tail and spitting what I cannot tell from one's mouth. Demons are creatures with a foot in the material world and in the furry door as well. They're magical bad boys, and they're lions and goats and hyenas and owls and frogs and cats. And Marchiosis in particular is very popular, kind of a fan favorite. for some reason, I don't know. She's not always figured that it is a cruel she-wolf. And the Goetia have, this is a twisted beast. I don't recommend anybody go there. They sell toys. The Goetia have some very specifically furry manifestations. This chart doesn't make a lot of sense. This is the 72 seals of the various Goetia demons. The ones that are in blue are ones that I could imagine basing a fursona on. Like, they kind of make sense as a design. They are an anthro character or a unicorn or whatever the hell this is. And they're very kind of furry in their nature. Almost half of them are like legit furry cred critters. And why is that? Demons are creatures of the earth, and in some ways, they're the lowest spirits. And a part of showing that is to give them animal characteristics to show that they are earthly. But also, in ancient traditions, demons that have animal characteristics are used for a great many spirits and gods to show that they are otherworldly as well. So it kind of does both. Before special effects, describing something as an animal was one of the ways to show that it was unique and strange. I will work with some... So starting with some quick definitions, Goetia can refer to either the magical tradition of Solomonic magic, where you bind these things and use angels to control them, but also it refers to a list of 72 specific spirits in a loose hierarchy of like kings and dukes and counts and knights and such. Each has their own specific list of spells or powers and gifts they can give, and it reads like a D&D player's manual, I think. So case in point, there's this guy here who I'm a big fan of. This is Buer, and he's known for teaching people pharmacy, botany, herbalism, and philosophy, natural sciences, liberal arts, rather. He is a president, but not in the way we think of a president, where like salute the flag president. It's more in the sense of like a chancellor or a chairman or something like that. Like a high-level bureaucratic person, I guess, would be looking at. And I think he looks pretty goofy in this picture. It's from the 1850s. But if you, this kind of shows a good way of thinking about the origins of these spirits. I go forward. Does anybody recognize this guy?
Charon.
Yeah, Charon. This is a centaur mentor. he's very sober. He's the only like sane and friendly, like not crazy centaur. And he teaches botany, medicine, natural philosophy, liberal arts. I can do the math for you if you're interested, but there's some linkages that suggest this guy originally... the Buer is based on this character. You can kind of see in his sigil, there's like four legs and a bow and arrow sort of thing. So these creatures can have some very old and unexpected connections. I'll quickly, I spent hours last year answering the question, what is a demon? And for now, I'm going to go with a demon as a creature, a spirit that is further from the divine and the gods and closer to the earth and the underworld and to humans as well. They tend to be more human than like angels who are weird. Some demons come from a time of primordial chaos where the gods were kind of fighting, the gods of civilization were fighting the forces of disorder and crazy and things like that. If you go back far enough, there is no epic good versus evil battle. Those terms have no meanings before about 400 BC or so. The main like axis of conflict was civilization and order versus primal chaos. And that carries forward with the demons as a category. They're not necessarily spirits of evil. If you go back far enough, that term doesn't mean anything anymore. This is Bune. He's usually seen as a sort of sea serpent thing. But as far back as we have myth, to about 500 BC, no epic battle of good versus evil. It was the gods of chaos, like Zeus and the Titans. Ask yourself if Zeus is a nice guy, if you'd even consider him good by any stretch of the imagination. He's a little bit rapey and kind of murdery. Yeah, and strange. But the nature of demons as a whole, this is a long history lesson. I'm trying to condense 5,000 years into 10 minutes. The nature of demons and religion kind of changes in the ancient Middle East around 400 BC or so, because of some serious influences like the Persian Empire washing over everybody, Zoroastrianism, and the Greeks as well. These change the story a little bit from order versus chaos to good versus evil, because the Persians had the concept of an epic battle of the forces of creation and honesty and honor versus evil, destruction, and lies. Asmodee is one refugee from this period. He was a spirit that used to be an assistant to Ahura Mazda, the great god of evil. I'm simplifying. And he moved from the Persian faith to the Abrahamic faith as Asmodeus, who in his one kind of semi-biblical story was stalking somebody's some lady he was in love with and bumping off all of her fiancés, and that's how he became associated with lust. His name actually is something like Wrath. He was king of the gem for a while. Hello. I like that the 1860 picture of him from the Dictionary Infernal has the little heads, and you can see where Vivzi kind of pulled that out. I like that a lot. It's worth knowing that the Goetia as a category are not the greatest hits. You won't find Lilith in there unless you look really hard. You won't find Satan, you won't find Leviathan. A lot of people in the Goetia are kind of like the biggest and best, but they're not really. There's 72 spirits that are there because sorcerers and magic users and hermetics decided they were spirits they could work with. So they're spirits that are willing to make a deal, but big scary things like Satan are not necessarily on that list, except maybe in kind of the hierarchy above it, as kind of suggested by their absence sort of thing. And they're not the same as the demons in the Bible necessarily. They are descended from them, but Asmodee in the Goetia does not have the tones of wrath and sex that he does in his ancient mythology in the Book of Tobit. They're different critters. They come from the same origin, but in some cases it's almost just the name is all that's inherited. Another trend around 400 or so is that Israel had too many gods. Israel had a lot of gods. A lot of people don't know this, but Judaism was in its infancy in like 900 BC or so, a polytheistic faith. They had about 8 gods, including big sky god, big sky god's wife, Baal, and Ashtaroth. Well, Asherah, most popular god Astarte, the most popular goddess ever. And as we move forward through to like 300 BC or so, Israel is having to centralize its faith. They're creating the Jewish faith from the Israelite faith. And a part of that is to get rid of all these extraneous gods and goddesses and call it down to one single god that doesn't make any promises but bans 100% loyalty. So a lot of these characters fade out, but they linger as demons. And people kind of believe that the Jewish faith turned all these pagan gods, ancient gods, into demons. And it's not really true because they turned their own gods into demons. It was kind of like the temple was, I mean, maybe unfair, but the temple's kind of gaslighting people, saying these spirits you worshiped for 1,000 years, they're bad. They're really bad. There's only Yahweh now. So it's this weird infighting myth. But Baal does make it into the Guesha. He's the number one in the Guesha, and very popular fertility god. Maybe why he lingers in having a lot of popularity later on. And I don't think that Astarte was ever his wife, really, but they kind of become associated with each other as a Hieros Gamos sacred marriage sort of thing. Also, she's the grimoirist of the 1600s, 1500s, decided that she was male, despite being the most popular goddess on the planet. But you can kind of see the edges of her female personality if you go digging very deep into her books. I'm going to pause for just a second there to see if there's any sudden questions. Yes?
Still trying to work it out, but there is like a kind of cultural shift, you would say, where demons, angels, spirits, whatever the name you might give it, as you say, there's kind of like a hierarchy being established, and sort of, how would you say, like, if there's like a retroactive kind of relationship there, like if you were to say, like, you know, going back from, singular Yahweh to pluralistic
Yahweh. Like you're hinting at, in the book of Genesis, in the creation story, it says, God created the heavens and the earth, but it's not God per se. The word they use is like God's plural female. This is the Elohim, the children of heaven. There's a concept going back, and it kind of like dies out in around 200 BC or so, of the divine council, where there's a swirl of spirits and ancestors and demons and angels and monsters and nymphs and musae that serve the high god, whoever that is, El or Yahweh, in his work and kind of do some of the work for him. That idea carries through ancient Greece. The word daimones kind of comes from this concept as well, this cloud of spirits that are not quite divine but have divine DNA. And that is not a hierarchy, but does have kind of a god at the top and this cloud of spirits beneath. You can find references to this in the Psalms as well if you look hard enough. But the kind of the firm hierarchy, the military hierarchy that the Goetia in particular have, that tends to be more of a feudal thing from like in the Middle Ages, from like 500 onwards. We'll touch on that. So moving forward a little bit to 200-ish or so BC, we get to a point where the Middle East is haunted by these ancient empires. In our recent past, we've lost like Greece as a real meaningful empire. Rome's ancient history is kind of fading. Mesopotamia is out there. Persia is out there. Israel has kind of fallen as a mainstream kingdom. The Canaanites are there beyond. And so this group of people that inherit magical traditions and ideas from all these faded empires start building lucrative careers as wandering mages. This is the beginning of the Goans, this kind of like trickstery figures. This is a really interesting image. I added this at the last minute. This is the first written reference to Jesus Christ. It translates into by Christ the magician or by Christ the wonder worker. But remember that word Goans is very loaded. So to compare Christ to this, I don't know what that means exactly. Nobody really knows what it means. But one theory is that this is not a coffee mug. It looks like a coffee mug. I would definitely drink coffee out of it. But it's a divination bowl, so you pour oil into it and you kind of see things in it. So this is an invocation of Christ to aid a Goans, to aid a magician. But it's really interesting that the first reference to Jesus written that anyone knows about, it's like 50 BC or 80 or so, has that funny slant to it. I don't know what that means. As everybody knows, wisdom is much more exciting when it's from far away. This is the truth. So all these wandering magi were like coming to locals over here and talking about like the mysteries of Egypt, which were always more exciting if they were way over there, or from Persia, which was way, way over there, but had crazy demon stuff anyway. So you get traditions like very strange names, weird entities that kind of are simultaneously Hebrew and Latin at the same time. This is the nominum barbarus, the barbaric names, uncouth names. And this tradition carries to today, like abracadabra, who knows, like that's a funny word and it sounds more magical because it's funny. You get a lot of things with X's in them as well and Z's. I don't know what that's about. This is actually a secret name of God, if anybody cares. I don't know the answers to it or not. So getting to furry stuff again, and talking about how exciting magic is when it's far away, and how all these different religious traditions are kind of colliding with each other. When you add Anubis to Hermes, you get Hermanubis, who is a Greek-ish, Romanish god of the underworld, partaking of Hermes, who's a messenger to the underworld, and Anubis, who is furry god of sodomy, I don't know, who's the god of undertaking and funerary practices. I like Hermanubis. He doesn't have very many mentions, but he's an interesting entity. And Hermes is quite a powerful figure, and he carries a lot of that power with him. But also he has ties to Hecate and Kerberos, the three-headed dog. And sometimes you can't tell if Kerberos and Hecate are not the same entity. They're very similar in places. But as the grimoires of the 13th, 14th, 15th century kind of pick him up, they create this fusion entity of Kerberos and Hermanubis. You can kind of see the echoes of the words in Nibirius. And in a sense, Kerberos lives in these grimoires through now, although he turns into a bird and has three heads and is kind of a poof. I can't explain that at all, but it's true. Okay, this is Epic Battle of Good versus Evil, which you kind of touched on already. A lot of these magical traditions kind of get smooshed into a document, like 70 documents that were collected from like 100 BC to 300 AD or so, called the Greek Magical Papyri. This is just this basic set of spells and incantations and things like that. And some of them are just jokes and funny, but they get kind of collated and then they resurface in the 1700s and add to like modern magical understandings in strange ways. But around this point in time, you see the axis of control and the axis of the universe shift from order versus chaos to good versus evil. Specifically, good being defined as what God says is good, and evil tending to be defined as what God is opposed to. And this is kind of more the understanding of demons that we get now, particularly after the 1500s, which I will touch on it as well. It's not a subtle difference, though. Like order versus chaos, you don't have to take sides there because everybody's kind of okay with civilization. But good versus evil is very judgy. And this again kind of plays into the kind of downward direction that demons take in terms of their relationship with humans as we go forward. By about 100 to 200, it's becoming more and more clear that Christianity is growing, it's spreading, and it's likely to be something more than like a weird little messianic Jewish cult. It's going to be something bigger, and you're kind of seeing the edges of this. And the first document that really touches on, this is the Testament of Solomon, which is arguably the most important magical text out there, particularly in like Western occultism. This is written about 200 AD or so, and you can tell it's written by like a Christian writer who's glossing and translating from Hebrew texts and stories. Solomon did not write this. Some desert monk may have. It's a timeless story. King builds a temple to Yahweh. Demon starts to suck the life force out of the king's favorite boy's thumb. Like that. Thumb is a euphemistic word. The king binds the demons, and ultimately binds every single demon and uses them to build a temple and get all their secrets, and the king sacrifices locusts to Baal and loses everything. It's a tale as old as time. There's some things that carry through here through the 21st century, though, which is the idea that Solomon uses pairs of like angels to bind demons. He uses the names of God to bind demons. He uses, in some cases, like Jesus Christ to bind demons, which is a little bit anachronistic if Solomon is from 700 BC or so. There you go. It's a Christian text. But this is the heart of Solomonic magic, this play between like the demon who causes a problem and the angel or the power that controls that demon and solves that problem. The Testament of Solomon is actually a very early medical text because it's this list of ailments and how to treat them, although you treat them with like spit and God. I don't know if it works very well. And then this is really about Christianity starts to evolve from a little mystery cult to a world empire religion by about 400 or so, when it becomes the official church of Rome. And you get this period that's not at all sexist called the patristic period, where you have Augustine and Pope Gregory and Ambrose and Origen, and the church is really trying to build up who it is and what they're about. and how to answer hard questions about evil when you're a monotheistic faith. So they invent a new story of evil, which is the story of Lucifer, the fallen angel. That's 300 BC AD or so. It's not biblical at all, but it's the story of how Lucifer or Satan fell and took a third of the host of heaven down with them. Smash. And there's not really anything demonologically interesting for about 1,000 years after that. And then it gets really complicated. By about 1300, I'm going somewhere. This body of work is really chaotic, and I'm trying to add order to something that is impossible to order. Over the next 1,000 years, the church gets very complacent in its role. It's kind of monolithic, generally well appreciated. The Middle Ages is not a bad time in some regards. There's not tons of war, and there's some crusades, but it's not like the Dark Ages. That's kind of a misnomer. But it is a place where the church gets larger, gets kind of corrupt, and gets entrenched into the feudal culture. There's a concept, which we touched on a little earlier, called the Great Chain of Being. That evolves right now as the church kind of allies with the state to create this hierarchy, which has God at the top. And all of us are somewhere in the middle, but obviously nowhere near God and nowhere near kings. We're somewhere under kings. And obviously men are higher than women on this totem. I mean, let's make that abundantly clear. I put lions underneath over turtles because lions have human-like faces. That's how you know they're better than turtles. I'll leave the butternut squash as an exercise to the reader. But she's up there. Did I put her over Jesus? No, not quite. So the Great Chain of Being frames everything in terms of layers of empire. The kingdom of God is with the angels as his armies, and that is served by the kingdom of man with armies as his armies. It's very feudal, very hierarchical, very rigid. This is where the Goetia inherit things like titles like kings and dukes and things like that. They're reflecting this Great Chain of Being. And the nobles like to see themselves written into these things as well. So like, oh, they've got dukes. Well, I'm a duke. I'm very exciting. I'll pay money to these people to write these things. But this is a very rigid structure. So predictably, it's going to explode. This is not a good chart. But it's going to explode for a number of reasons. And I wanted to kind of put them all together in one place so you can kind of see what's going to make the Middle Ages explode. These periods don't actually mean anything, like the Reformation does not start on January 30th, 2000, whatever. These are kind of hazy terms. The Middle Ages runs through about 1450 AD or so, depending on who you ask. But in the 1300s, society is really rocked by a couple of things. We've got plague, we've got the Crusades, the end of the Crusades, the sense that the Inquisition is starting to be a corrupt organization that's serving a corrupt church. The Black Death, that was not a fun thing. But everything changes with the Gutenberg press. I can actually make a very good comparison. The Gutenberg press is like the internet, because suddenly all of this information that was locked up in ancient books that were handwritten was mass produced. So there's this surge in literacy. At the far right, you can see the number of grimoires, like new grimoires that are produced per year, per like 10-year block, I think. That kind of goes off there. And it's one and one and one. These are handwritten texts. So when you get the printing area, you get two, then eights, and sevens, and eights, and things like that. The number of books are being ramped up because the printing press is hungry for material because you can sell that shit. And there's a pulp publishing industry. It needs books. And all these strange, magical texts are exciting, and they start to feed that hungry thing, the press. The Renaissance was also a time when a lot of ancient lore from like Greece, like those magical papyri that we talked about, the Testament of Solomon, they get uncovered, they get shuffled into Europe from Alexandria and other points south. And there's suddenly this rediscovery of ancient ideas, philosophies, and wisdom. We'll put that in quotes. In particular, magic becomes very exciting because it was discussed all the time back then. It's been kind of laying low with the church not approving it for about 1,000 years. The Kabbalah is very exciting too. People are uncovering Jewish writings and reinterpreting them with Egyptian mythology and things like that. This explosion of occult stuff happens. People are interested in Egypt and Greek and ancient philosophies and concepts of magic. It's a boom time for occult philosophy. This guy is named Aeon. No one knows much about him. He's also called the Leontocephaline, which means lion head. What I can tell you right now is he's got a snake wrapped around him. He's kind of in the style of a caduceus, so there's kind of some echoes of Hermes and Mercury there. No one quite knows what he is. He was associated with Mithras worship, and some people suggest that he's kind of in some way carries Mithras's immortality with him. He's a very mysterious creature, and there's not a clear idea of what he is. But in the Testament of Solomon, there's a spirit named Ornius, who is a lion that turns into fire, that turns into a snake, it turns into a gay man. Don't ask. And he's associated with like the knowledge of angels and destiny and things like that. He knows cosmic things, despite the fact that his name means something like the annoying one. And I don't think I've seen anybody directly associating them, but kind of indirectly, Ornius is associated with Orion's, the demon king of the East. And there's a whole shitload of lion demons, like four of them, and they're all involved in technology. I think that's because this architectural concern lion from way back working with the Testament of Solomon, who has this cosmic association, gets rolled forward and turns into like a couple other spirits. All these lions are like into architecture and snakes. Orius in particular is into architecture and technology and transforming men. I think there's some fanfic to be written there somewhere. There's not a direct link, but there's a lot of lines that are like this. Back to this chart. So the Renaissance, one group is not very happy with the sudden explosion of knowledge and curiosity, and that is the church. They're starting to crack down heresy and really flexing their muscles and trying to like control the way religion is spread. They create special groups devoted to rooting out sorcery and heresy. They don't distinguish these things anymore. Witchcraft is heresy, is unbelief. So this rise in studying magic comes at the same time as there's a rise in the interest of killing people who practice magic. The witch hunts were specifically, allegedly, about destroying a conspiracy of Satanists that were going to wipe out the world, mostly women. But in practice, no one really believed that this conspiracy existed. The church needed to create this to kind of prove to themselves that there was a god. It's a very dark time. And around 1550 or so, some guy posts 93 theses on a wall, on a door, and suddenly the church explodes. And no one believes the same thing anymore, which means everybody else believes bad things and they're evil. And this kind of spreads into this period of fascination with the occult. This morbid horror story is unfolding in the north, like Germany and Scotland. People in the south are better than that, but they're fascinated by these witches and these demons and things like that. And this conspiracy that they keep hearing about. And it's dark and fascinating and kind of sexy. And again, this is kind of where you start getting a rise in the creation of the grimoires, the texts that describe these demons. It's a strange thing. The Goetia tradition is 2,000 years old, but its modern form is tied up in this aura of fear and fascination. This is an interesting thing I learned recently. The first published list of what would become the Goetia is it's the Libertas Spiritus. It's like a book of spirits. And it's got like 53 named spirits in it, of which way more than half don't really seem to exist anywhere else. I'll get back to that. But the inheritor of this was a man named Johann Weyer, who, if you're into psychology as your field, is, you know the man? He's considered the founder of psychiatry. This is in 1577 or so. So it's a bit dated. But he was a physician that was asked to report on a witch trial and say whether this makes sense or not. He said, no, it doesn't make any sense at all. This is crazy stuff. These people obviously have a mental condition or something and should be treated as such. They're not demon-possessed. That's a nonsense thing. And he wrote a very thick book about it called The False Tricks of Spirits. And there was later on, in later edition, he wrote an appendix to it, a very small appendix, called Pseudomonarchium Demonium, The False Hierarchy of Demons, which begins with, here's some silly things these silly people believe. And it lists 69 demons. You start to get into, shush, why are you making that face? become the core of the list of 72 Goetia now. And it begins with, these are silly things. Why do people do this? And not only that, but this is a magical system and I'm kind of making it to where it doesn't work. I'm taking a lot of most important things, but he'd love this. This copy does not mention any of those things, just mentioned the demons, because that was the fun part. And so while being this psychiatrist and this rationalist and humanist, he's also the father of demonology, and I'm sure he'd hate that. Sorry, taking my notes. Okay. So at the same time, the church is kind of breaking down. People are disagreeing with the idea of God in some ways. The world is increasingly humanist. There was a satanic panic started in Scotland, and the King of England was Scottish, by the way, King James, who wrote that Bible, well, who commissioned that Bible thing. He also wrote a book called Demonology, where he's saying, no, the witchcraft stuff is real, guys. This is scary stuff that we need to be afraid of. So the King of England is pushing a satanic panic moment. It's a really bad, it's an exciting time for the occult. It's a bad time to be dabbling in the occult. But that is the context for the Grimoire Renaissance, all these booms of like new products and things that are put out there. Kind of some logical flows. The Greater Key of Solomon is not the source of all these. It's kind of a book of general magical ideas and traditions. It talks a lot about angels and theurgy. Hygromantia is, along with The Greater Key of Solomon, are two books that kind of go back in time and pick up these 300, 400 AD traditions and bring them into the 1400s or so. So once those are published, everybody kind of leaps on them, and all these books are kind of reference each other and draw from each other, and they share sources and things like that. It's very hard to distinguish one from the other. But the Pseudomonarchia Demonicum flows into the Lamegaton, which is the Lesser Key of Solomon, which is absolutely one of the most famous occult texts. That first book of the Lesser Key of Solomon is called Ars Goetia, the Goetic Arts, and that lists the 72 spirits along with their magical symbols and sigils and things like that, that really kind of form the basis, with some variations, of the Grimoire of Rival Demons and through today. I do recommend, if you're interested in this, the Goetia of Dr. Rudd, which repurposes Ars Goetia, etc. And it's one of the most influential grimoires out there because it was English and has a lot of like angel versus demon stuff in it. It's a really good book. You can thumb through my copy later on. Okay, that's the end of the history lesson. Let's talk about this guy for a little bit. So as I mentioned, can someone time check me, please?
12:10.
Okay, good. I'm on time. Stolas is a fan favorite among demon people because he's so weird. That bird there is very strange. There's very little. So in the Liber de Spiritus, I do have a copy of it over here. There's like 30 spirits that occur earlier. Maybe they're in the Testament of Solomon, maybe they're Asmodeus, maybe they're Kerberos, maybe they're Baal, these ancient spirits, but like 40 of them are like whole cloth names that have no reference points. They're just kind of created. And frequently they have nothing going on with them at all. The sum total we know about Stolas is Great Prince, Night Raven, teaches astronomy. You see that in Vizipop's things where he's always surrounded by stars and gems and things like that. And he's got 20 legions under him. Someone explained to me the word, the 26 legions is derived somehow from the word Stolas in numerology based on his name. I don't know. That was kind of interesting. But a lot of the Goetia are these kind of empty stubs where you can't find anything else. And when I'm talking with some kind of demon fan people, it's like, I want to know more about X demon. It's like, well, I can tell you three words about him. And that's all that's written there because there's just nothing else. But there are some that have older histories and draw from older references. Gamagin, Semagina, oh, you can't see his name, what's up there? This demon is, he's interested in purgatory, in the souls that are trapped there. He usually appears as a pale horse. So you can kind of see there's biblical reference there, kind of Old Testament stuff, the death rides on a pale horse sort of thing. And that's carried in him. He becomes a demon that kind of incorporates that idea. Anamalak. This is a demon who's specifically mentioned in the Bible as someone that people sacrifice children to. And I don't want anybody to get the idea that it was just Anamalak. I think everybody just sacrifice children to people because it's funsies. I haven't really worked out that, but like most, Israel has a reputation for sacrificing children to Yahweh and then calling it Moloch, which is not a demon name per se, but it's just kind of a word meaning king. Anyway, child sacrifice is not limited to any one deity or demon. This particular fellow in the late 1700s, there's a crazy demonologist whose name has like 27 words in it and ends with Berbiguar. And he decides that this guy, who is an ancient god, is also the supervisor of Satan's wardrobe, which I buy that, actually. And his name is Samael, which, if you know your research, Samael is another name for Satan himself. So maybe this is an older spirit that we give him credit for. I don't know. I don't know where this spirit came from. Anyway, sometimes they take the easy way out, like grimoires. So that's kind of a brief summary of some of the demons. I'm going to talk a little bit about magic in a moment, but I'll stop there and see if anybody wants to kind of interject. Any questions? Thoughts? Okay. Well, this is Phoenix. Like, this is a retelling of Phoenix, but in a 16th century grimoire. They call him Phoenix and say he looks like a phoenix. That's so dull. Like, try harder, guys. Try harder. He is pretty. He's got a beautiful voice, and if you listen to it, you'll fall under his spell or her spell. And so, demonologists and sorcerers are advised to not listen to him. Yes?
You had mentioned previously about the 72 demons that, in the Archaeology, people could, bind for service, or in the Solomon tradition. Was there, a corresponding 72 angels that would be used in particular instances for that kind of monitoring?
Yes and no. In the Testament of Solomon, 200 AD or so, there's the idea that these demons are frequently bound by angels. The idea that there's a precise correspondence is, I think, a 15th century idea. In the 15th century, this is Shakespeare period, a lot of occult scholars, and it's worth pointing out that occult and science are the same thing until about 1650 or so, Francis Bacon, Roger Bacon. But a lot of writers pick up the idea that Kabbalah, which is heavily based on 72 is a magical number tied to the stars in some way, and 3 × 2 × 2 × 3, et cetera. It's an old magical number, but there's 72 nodes in the Kabbalah Tree of Life idea. And so some writers get the idea that the 72 demons obviously must be matching up with 72 angels in some way that directly creates this correspondence. The idea of the Klipoth, it's not the Tree of Death. It's much more complex and interesting than that. But kind of this dark version of the Tree of Life comes up. People really like correspondences because there's this horrible fixation of order. But in practice, the angel versus demon thing is actually in the Goetia of Dr. Rudd, which is a late 1600s document, I think. So it's a fairly recent development, but it's tied to a lot of ideas, particularly the idea that everything is in this big, rigid, crystalline order thing, which is very Shakespeare-y, or Shakespearean period. So talking a little bit about magical traditions, and I'm going to be super generalizing here. Feel free to tell me I'm wrong later on, but I'm going for jokes rather than actual occultism. The Solomonic magical tradition is kind of the name that's given to binding these demons with angels, etc. Particularly the 72 demons of the Goetia, although not always the case. And it's maybe worth talking about what does that look like. I think there's three kind of main models. I'm, again, very oversimplifying. And I obviously like Goetic magic. I think it's really neat. But I also think it's kind of the BDSM of the occult world, and there's reasons for that. But Goetic magic, Solomonic magic, is very transactional. If you're a pagan, you might reverence Diana and celebrate Diana, but you wouldn't necessarily ask Diana for a big fistful of cash or a car. You probably wouldn't ask her for a babe. But if you're a Goetic sorcerer, of course you'd ask these demons for cash and cars and babes. These demons are very human. They know what we like. We like cars, sex, and money, and turning men into other things. I don't know. Anyway, so it's very transactional. And I think that's another reason why most Western traditions kind of diss on Goetic magic, because magic is supposed to be about enlightenment and self-actualization and reaching a higher plane, not about asking demons for cash. That's tacky. Anyway, Goetic magic is not cerebral at all. You do tend to ask things for very specific rewards. It's kind of like, I do this, I put the $5 bill in, and theoretically the demon gives me this, this, and this. You wouldn't even think to ask Diana for things like that. Sorry about the AI artwork. I know that's kind of taboo, but it's what I had in a hurry. Solomonic magic is, I think it's the dominance and sadism aspect of this. Fundamentally, it's about using angels and god magic to control demons and force them to give you knowledge and magic in a car. The practitioner generally stays inside of a protected circle, conjures the demon into a triangle, uses the demon's sigil, and his opposing angel to stick him in the magical triangle and bind him there. And if the demon does not immediately give him cake or babes, then you start threatening him with soul torture. If you don't obey me instantly, I shall take the sigil and put it in the flaming flame of flames, and you shall burn, burn, burn forever. There's more to it, but this is kind of the like high-level view. And over time, the Solomonic magic practitioner might develop a relationship with these spirits and stop like badgering them in that way and just kind of work with them. But I feel like that's an uphill road and you're kind of at a disadvantage already. Some of the pagan people in my acquaintanceship have an eclectic approach, and they tend to, those that do, might have an array of deities that they work with. Maybe they work with Diana and Bast. One of my friends is a very big Hecate fan. Hecate is fairly chthonic and has demonic ties on her own. But amongst his circle of deities on his altar, he's put Vasago, who's kind of this ancient Jedi Knight sort of character, who's one of the Goetic demons. So an eclectic type might bring in some of these things. Maybe they want fast cash. Maybe they just appreciate the aesthetic of a creature. Maybe it resonates with them somehow. But they might incorporate these demons into their practices because these are very well-known spirits. Neo-paganism tends to draw from an awful lot of sources. It's an eclectic mix. Lastly, and again, I'm simplifying, there's the dominance-submission angle of demonolatry. And these are people that primarily worship demons and chaotic spirits, or really tie their spiritual identity into these entities. And they're really not necessarily that different from like any other kind of pantheistic pagan type, but they wear a lot more black. And I'm making generalities here. Demon type people are very individualistic. They're very solitary. They don't tend to have like community beyond like trading some ideas and things like that. There's not like rules or, there are books. They're not very good. I have one with me. So it's hard to make any generalizations about these people. But one can safely say that they often have a favorite demon who's kind of at the top of their personal pantheon, and they have another series of spirits they work with down below that's maybe not the number one thing. They frequently use words like pact with words like forever on it. I mean, fundamentally, they're pagans in black, but they may have a deeper tie to these demons than some people might be comfortable with. But again, these spirits are not necessarily evil. They're not necessarily good. Everything I said about the history of them was true at the time, but all of that still kind of lives within these spirits now. Any given Goetic demon has ties to the ancient past, is tied to the Greek period, the Egyptian period, where spirits could be negotiated with, where evil wasn't necessarily on the agenda, destruction and chaos, and hurting people might be, but not specifically evil. And they carry this legacy of a time when good and evil weren't the strongest distinctions into a world where suddenly it's the most important thing. So demonolaters tend to have more ambivalent, more nuanced ideas of what a demon is, and yet they still wear an awful lot of black. I'm going to pause there. Actually, it's largely the end of my... that's the end of my slideshow. Couple more ideas I want to touch on, but does anybody have anything you'd like to go back on? Or yeah.
So I just kind of noticed this at random with some of the images that you pulled up, but it seemed like some of the drawings had a little bit of a bird face on the butt coming off. I don't know if that's stylistic or if there's a reason for
it. A bird face on the butt?
Yeah.
Did I include that? I don't remember I did or not. Oh, yeah. Those were like medieval woodcuts. I have nice things to say about the medievals. They weren't very comfortable with sex. So one thing that demons frequently have shown to be corrupt is they would have orifices that are not normally found there. Well, they had like, you know, face crotches and face butts and sometimes face knees. I don't know what that means. But this kind of showed the alienness and the corruption of those spirits in a very shorthand sort of way. Sexual distortion was kind of a thing. If you look at the art of Hieronymus Bosch, you'll see an awful lot of that sort of thing. But it makes them alien and disgusting.
Thank you.
Important words. That's it. Yeah.
It's interesting talking about, you know, how the traditional Solomonic stuff is kind of coercive and all that, because there's actually been kind of I don't know if it would be called completely pagan, semi-pagan, pagan-like movement in recent years, sort of almost a goetic renaissance, mm-hmm. more towards like trying to be more cooperative,
yes.
and less coercive.
Things Levy and Crowley kind of picked up.
And more recently, the late Jake Stratton Kent.
Oh, bless his heart. He was wonderful.
Yeah.
If you're interested in this stuff, Jake Stratton Kent is an amazing writer. Do be prepared to have some coffee while you read. He's very challenging.
It's very dense. You know, even like online classes like Jason Miller's Black School of St. Cyprian, mm-hmm. things like that. There's all kinds of like really interesting and new approaches to this material out there these days.
Yeah, and you can get most of the major grimoires that I've listed and dozens of others for free now, which is also probably kind of channeled into this idea. There's been a recent, in the last like 20 years or so, a big surge in people studying this form of magic. And that's largely because people can apply like comparative religious techniques to these ancient documents, but they have them as well. I have a problem with a lot of this because particularly Crowley and Levy tend to say that these are, like Crowley says, the Goetia are just elements of your psyche. And they kind of take away from the, like, does this thing have toes and fur, physicality of the demons to make them these cerebral things. And I think that's kind of whitewashing them for ceremonial purposes. Crowley was a ceremonial magician. And I think that takes away from a lot of what makes the Goetia interesting to me, is they are earthy spirits.
It's convenient that most of these are public domain, but not every translation is great.
that's fair. But yeah, Stratton Kent has some amazing things. I've got a couple of grimoires over here if you want to play with them. I've got a copy of Le Megaton. I have... if you happen to be interested in demon worship as a spiritual path, I don't necessarily recommend it, but this book is kind of what the internet says about demonology all in one go. It's filled with bad stuff and misinformation, but it's also a really good place to start and like look for ideas. I don't know what it says in Japanese, but this is a cute anime girl's Goetia. It's really adorable. I'm a fan favorite. Beer is my favorite, and her picture here is really cute. And this is Goetia Kids. It is adorable. Anyway, I'm going to shut the microphone down. If y'all want to join me for questions and things like that, I don't think there's anybody else following me. You're welcome to stick around. Please, like, if you're interested in Chthonic mythology and things like that, my podcast has a lot of jokes in it. It's good stuff. And, I'm happy to answer more questions. This is like my major hobby these days. This podcast is copyright 2023 by The Dispatchist and is Creative Commons. You're welcome to reuse with attribution. Look for us on your favorite podcast app. Say hi to us on Twitter or Gmail at The Dispatchist, no spaces. Check out our website, dispatch.ist, for episodes, show notes, and a variety of hellish resources.